This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 13th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 364. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, first, the MMA panel reconvenes to analyze the election campaign so far and look ahead to the October 19th election day. I'm joined by Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. Then, what lies beyond the October 19th election when it comes to First Nations land settlements in BC? Jeffrey Moyse, who advised six BC governments on Aboriginal land use issues, is my guest. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It's a special BC election edition of the MMA panel as we count down the days and the hours to October 19th election day here in BC. I'm Mackin, and joining me are Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program, the M and the A in the MMA panel. I asked Mario and Andy to join me after the two debates, October 2nd at CKNW and October 8th at CBC. We'll start off with you, Mario Canseco. Who won those debates, and will it matter at the ballot box?
I don't think there was necessarily a winner. I think Sonia Furstenau connected well on the things she needed to talk about. It's unfortunate that we're running into people who are desperate to vote for the Green Party and can't find a candidate in their riding. I find it bizarre that the Saskatchewan Green Party manages to run a full slate of 61 candidates, just a couple of provinces to the east. And the Green Party in British Columbia, the first one that actually elected somebody to a legislative assembly, could not do it when they had 4 years to get ready for this. And it's similar to 2020 in the sense that people emerged from that debate saying Sonia Furstenau is great, but it didn't actually mean a lot when it came to votes and seats. David Eby was not particularly stellar, but I don't think he needed to be. I think it was more, you know, trying to talk about certain things that you want to do, acknowledging that there's more that needs to be done. At this type of debate, the onus is on the leader of the opposition, in this case, not the official opposition, of course, but somebody who's better positioned to try to become the vehicle for change, to try to establish an emotional connection. And I don't think John Rostad was able to do that. I seriously question his debate preparation, looking at different things, not really mentioning specifics when it came to questions. He was asked a couple of times to really answer what he was being asked. The over-reliance on the phrase laser-focused, the situation related to discussing policy within the standpoint of memes. Andrew Weaver wrote a few days ago that it looked like the conservative campaign was being designed by 20-year-olds from Alberta, and the debate clearly showed it.
The conservative ad campaign includes an ad, a very emotional ad with his wife, Kim, talking about John Rostad as a husband who couldn't be a father because she overcame cervical cancer. But we haven't got the same kind of ad from Rostad himself speaking directly to the camera, saying, "I'm John Rostad, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, and this is why I love British Columbia." We don't have that. That's something that's missing, and I think that's something that is going to harm him at the ballot box. Andy Yan, when you watch the debates, October 2nd from CKNW, October 8th produced at CBC for the broadcast consortium, what were your feelings? Who do you think won those debates, and will it matter at the ballot box for you?
Well, I think it mattered to the extent that I don't think there was a winner, but there was certainly a loser. And that loser was actually John Rostad, that was his moment to shine, his alternative to kind of show up in terms of I am the alternative to David Eby. And he didn't do it. He tried going with basically a response by memes, a a level of answers by repeating. I think the other thing that he also responded was how one in two young people want to leave the province of British Columbia, and I think that it just didn't land, that those hits didn't land. And then at the same time, I think David Eby, I think was able to just avoid the hits. Like he was able to kind of sidestep really a lot of the punches. But I think at the same time, if there did somebody who did kind of spark up, I think Sonia Furstenau did spark up. But then the issue I think there is, could it would it ever transfer into votes that could get them additional seats? And I think that really is challenging. I think given the kind of overall history of actually Sonia doing very well in debates, but yet not necessarily having the kind of additional votes reflected. So I think that there wasn't a particular winner, but then there was certainly a loser, I would say.
The NDP campaign, of course, it's got the biggest war chest, it's got the most money, most expertise, and it shows, but it's a campaign that has relied on half-truths or full-on disinformation. This is a campaign different from previous NDP campaigns. The previous NDP campaigns were very, very fact-heavy. They did their research, they showed their research. This time around, they are fabricating things. $4.1 billion healthcare cut, they say John Rustad will do if he becomes premier is just not true. The other part of the NDP ad campaign has been casting John Rustad as a major decision maker in the previous Liberal BC Liberal governments when he wasn't. He wasn't the premier, we know. He also wasn't the finance minister, was not the health minister, was not the education minister, was not the energy minister, not attorney general, not solicitor general. He was under Christy Clark, the Aboriginal Relations Minister, and then briefly Forest Minister. Do you think that NDP ad campaign will turn people off?
Is this where the median shapes the message? That I think that given all this, it's how everything you've talked about just kind of fits nicely into a meme or into a TikTok video, that this is an assertion in terms of trying to kind of meet into the realities of what's happening in terms of the diminishment of broadcast news, and into the rise of social media and the unfortunate issues around how that becomes a vehicle towards misinformation. I think that it's really one for which I think is an interesting question, because and part of it is because the last election was a COVID election, but you got to remember it was also the lowest turnout in almost 25 years of elections in British Columbia. That I think that is actually a larger issue. I think at the same time, I think to the credit of Elections BC, I think they really tried hard to get people aware of an election, just to get people to have various means of participating in an election. But yet, but then I think, does this turn off people? Does this turn off young people off of our processes? I think that this is really one of the kind of bigger challenges towards liberal democracies, not only in this province, but then across the country and across the world. And I think that this is really one of the big challenges in terms of really what does our various means of communications and really mean in a liberal democracy, and the role of truth.
There's a couple of things that I think require a deeper analysis. It's true that the campaign has been focusing a lot on Rostad's presence in the previous BC Liberal governments. In my estimation, you have about a decade, maybe 11 or 12 years, where you can still point to what the other governments did. And we saw that in 2017, when the Christy Clark Liberals kept saying the NDP is coming back and the NDP of the 90s and everything was terrible. And now you have a bunch of voters who probably don't even remember the 90s. And I think this is the last opportunity for the NDP to say the big bad BC Liberal government that was so bad to everybody, including Gordon Campbell and Christy Clark, might come back under John Rostad. So I don't think it's the best type of campaign. I think there's a lot of young voters who don't care about something like this. And this is also problematic, because the one thing that has been different from the data in this election is to see the over 55s solidly behind the NDP. They think the status quo is fine. They're not worried about some of the problems that their younger cohorts are worried about. And you have the 18 to 34-year-olds seriously flirting with voting for the Conservatives, not only federally, but also provincially. Now, how is that going to look in the next final days, and whether they actually show up and vote? But it's a fundamental change for a party that was used to, and we can remember the elections of 2009, 2013, when they kept saying, we don't care if the youth won't vote for us. We have the support of the over 55s, and we know they vote at a higher rate. So this is why we're forming the government again. Now it's a completely different situation for them, because the over 55s are not looking at the NDP as the NDP of the 90s that is going to wreck everything. And that is the group that they need to connect with. You don't get to connect with the over 55s through memes.
Will any independents break through? If so, where?
I don't know. Like I mean, I'm curious about seeing how Wendy Wan is going to do in Richmond Center and Richmond, I think Richmond Center, and what's going to happen there. And because she was I think a promising BC United candidate that was not carried forward. But then, of course, the biggest issue, and mind you, it is kind of contained to to the last section segment there, is really how many BC Liberals will vote BC Conservative. I think that part of this is really trying to keep the doors open for the BC Liberals who won't vote Conservative, perhaps even consider the NDP in some cases. So I wonder if the focus on John Rustad is really an attempt to kind of keep the door open for those who BC Liberals who don't find an appeal to the BC Conservative message. And I it's a very interesting question because I mean in some of my modeling, I mean it's such a critical element for the Conservatives to have any hope of winning some of these seats is the fact that there is going to be a close transfer of BC Liberal votes to BC Conservatives. And I think that that's really one of the big challenges. But yet this role of the independents, I think how much the independents will be spoilers, I think is a really interesting question. And for whom?
American Seiko.
Historically, we haven't had an independent elected since Vicky Huntington. Jason Lom or Jeremy Lom, I think, in Chilliwack came in very close to 25, 26% of the vote in the last election in 2020. And a lot of people thought he had a shot because he had been a long-serving councillor, somebody who was very well known, and ends up, maybe not playing a spoiler role, but certainly not getting to the level of support that's needed to secure the seat. Now, this is a different situation, and I think part of what is going to be quite difficult for the independents is that they won't have the machinery that was at their disposal before. I mean, you look at somebody like Karen Kirkpatrick, you look at Wendy Yuan, you look at even the candidates up north who had a significant war room with people making the phone calls and ensuring that they showed up and cast the ballot. You don't have that type of office when you're running as an independent. So that definitely makes it more difficult to get out the vote. And the other thing that could affect the chances of independent candidates is just how close this election is. If we wind up in a scenario where there's a 2-point difference between the main parties, if you really want to get the BC NDP out of office, you're going to go conservative, even if you really like your independent candidate. And the same thing happens if you're somebody who desperately wants to see the BC NDP reelected, and you're terrified at the prospect of John Rostad becoming premier, then you gravitate to that. The BC Liberal voter in 2020 is breaking 2-1 for the Conservatives, but it's not perfect. I think in the assumption that whatever Kevin Falcon says is what a lot of voters are going to do isn't really panning out. And part of the problem is they never actually had a concerted effort to have a merger that made sense. There's a parallel universe where Kevin Falcon and John Rostad set their egos aside and unite properly in December of 2023, and the United Conservative Party, or whatever you want to call it, is at 50 or 51% in the polls. It just didn't happen because they didn't want to.
What do you think the final score will be on October 19th? Start with you, Andy Yan.
Oh boy. Oh, I'm voting for Curtis. That's basically what I'm going to do. No, the that's that I think, I am leaning these days for probably a NDP win with a small election and with a small sorry, with a small majority and a wish that they held this election 3 months ago. That I think when it comes to a seat count, 50? 51? Around there? All right. I'm done.
Yeah,
Mariano Pacheco.
I'm with Andy. Having to have a BC election followed by a Saskatchewan election followed by a United States election is probably not the best thing for somebody in my position. So I would have been happy if they had done this in May, and they probably would have too because they were significantly ahead. I think it's very close to what Andy was saying. I think the NDP will get to 50 seats. The Conservatives will get about 42. I think there will be one green seat. I think the wild card here is going to be Chris Hergesheimer, who is running in Sunshine Coast. I think it'll be very difficult to get more than that, and I don't see any independents winning at this particular stage. But you could look at this in very different ways the day after. You could say, okay, they maybe managed to get a majority, but there were moments when it seemed more attainable. And ultimately, I think this causes a new race on October 20th, which is what happens with the Conservative Party.
Right.
If the seats where they were asked repeatedly to reconsider the candidates are lost, then there's going to be a lot of discussion about we were so close to winning this thing and we didn't make the right decision. So John Ross, that's days as leader of the BC Conservatives, are numbered. We would have a discussion with whoever is left on the caucus, maybe somebody like Eleanor Sturco or Gavin Dew, or maybe Todd Stone wants to come back into the fold and try to reunite this thing, have a convention, figure out a way to do things, and then fight the good fight again in 4 years. But just a couple of weeks ago, this seemed attainable, and now it doesn't look as certain as it did.
This could also set them up to the conservatives to completely break away from the BC Liberals, like completely break away from the Christy Clark years and just say, we are totally new from where we are, which is actually the irony of why Kevin Falcon was perhaps the best candidate for David Eby for BC, whether BC Liberals, conservatives, sorry, BC Liberals, BC United, and whatever the heck they were going to call else they had the ideas to call themselves. That I think what will be interesting is in perhaps the next election, when that break from that BC Liberal era is could be complete, and running against, like, we're look at the BC Liberals may not work anymore.
We can't bid $1 like you do on The Price is Right, but I'm going to go lower. I'm going
Oh,
lower, lower, lower. I'm going
okay.
to say the NDP will win 45 seats and have a minority. And they'll
Ooh,
be
that's super
talking
close.
to a couple other MLAs and offer them some sweet deals to come on over to support them, a confidence of supply agreement or a cabinet seat. Something's gonna happen there. They're going to have to do some post October 19th politicking to stay in power. I think that there's enough there, enough people that are unhappy with the NDP across the province, but maybe not happy enough to join the Conservatives. But I think there's going to be a lot some losses along the way, but I don't think it's going to be enough to sink the NDP. I think we're in a very polarized situation, like we are nationally and have been for several years, the right and the left and the middle wondering where to go because the middle is bigger. So I think that's what I'm saying. 45 seat NDP minority, just a hair below where they need to be in majority territory. So that's where we are and
All
looking for.
right, beers on a patio. We'll put beers on a patio, but we'll have to kind of, I think, wear, well, I think insulate up.
Bob wants 2017 again. It's interesting.
Oh,
Like the
yeah.
clock. At least it's not 1996, you know?
Yeah.
When, by the way, the number one song in Canada, ironic by Alanis Morissette, Gordon Campbell gets more votes, but fewer seats.
Well, I've got one hand in my pocket, the other hand on the button about to end the recording. Thanks again for joining us on the podcast, the MMA panel. I'm the first M, Mackin, and we got the other M, Mario, as in Mario Canseco from Research Co., and the A is as in Andy Yan, the director of the City program from Simon Fraser University, the Duke of Data. Thanks again. The NDP government did an about-face early this year on a controversial proposal to co-manage Crown land with BC's 200 First Nations. Then it made the Haida Title Lands Agreement outside the treaty process. Questions persist. What will David Eby do if his NDP government is re-elected on October 19th? Will the Land Act amendments return? Will the Haida Agreement be replicated on BC's mainland? On September 19th, just 2 days before the election writ announcement, David Eby dismissed a question about the future of the Land Act.
Is that the position of your government, that Land Act changes would give the power of land title for First Nations or the minister to supersede somebody's individual land rights?
No, not at all, Richard. And I guess what I would say about this is, you know, we have seen candidate after candidate, including the leader of the Conservative Party, advancing conspiracy theories. Everything from the leader saying that climate change is a hoax, that it's a lie, that we're carbon beings, therefore carbon pollution can't be real.
This is what debate moderator Shachi Curl asked Eby on October 8th.
Your proposed Land Act changes have faced criticism over impacts on individual land rights, treaty negotiations, and major resource developments, including those supported by First Nations. If you win this election, will you again attempt to amend the Land Act?
No, we won't, Sonia. And the reason is that we need to make sure that we have the confidence of British Columbians in doing this critically important work.
Time and again, the courts have ruled in favor of Aboriginal title. So when you, as Premier, are in a situation where you are negotiating over what to do with Crown land, which is considered public land, whose interests are you prioritizing?
Well, that's a critically important question, Shachi. Thank you. And the best way I can describe it to you is to talk to you about the agreement we did with the Haida people. You know, recognizing Haida title, everybody knew government wasn't going to win in court. Haida have been there since time immemorial. They've got their own governance. They've been looking after different functions. And so when we entered into an agreement with the Haida, it was to make sure that we were sitting down as partners at a table with shared responsibility. We're going to work it out. We're not going to go to court. And that's what we did. That's how we got to an agreement with the Haida.
But on October 9th, the day after the debate, this headline in The Guardian: it's pathbreaking British Columbia's blueprint for decolonization. First Nations are negotiating with government on sharing crucial decisions over forestry, mining, and construction. The Royal Proclamation of 1763 said Aboriginal people were not to be dispossessed of their land without a treaty. BC, however, is unique in Canada. Most of the 200 First Nations have no treaty. Section 35 of the 1982 Constitution recognizes the inherent right of self-government for Aboriginal people, but it does not define it. Not until the 1990s did making treaties with First Nations become a priority in BC, but it has proceeded at glacial speed. BC's process to make treaties with the federal government and individual First Nations is now 32 years old, but there are only 7 treaties for self-government. 30 First Nations are negotiating, but 28 are not. Many First Nations leaders complain that millions of dollars go to lawyers rather than to educating the next generation of First Nations children who are living in poverty on reserves. In 2019, John Horgan's NDP government adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It is not a treaty or binding international law, but Horgan began it as a project that is reconciliation themed to align BC's laws with the principles of UNDRIP. My guest is retired lawyer Jeffrey Moyse. He's the former executive counsel in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General for British Columbia. He joined the BC government in 1991 when the province joined the Nisga'a negotiations. Jeffrey Moyse advised 6 BC governments over 30 years on Aboriginal land issues. He says a sleeper issue in the October 19th election is the future of Crown land and possibly private land in British Columbia. Now, early this year, we found out that the NDP government wanted to amend the Land Act to share management of Crown lands with First Nations. It took a step back. It decided not to because of pressure, political pressure, when it became public. But one thing that did happen was the NDP government made a unilateral declaration of Aboriginal title for Haida Gwaii, for the Haida people. So these two major announcements, two major initiatives, one that didn't happen this year, but one that did happen this year, how they're related and what they mean for British Columbians.
Sure. Okay, so let's start with the Land Act proposed amendments. You might want to know where those came from. And the answer is in the DRIPA legislation, that's the provincial legislation, which mentions UNDRIP. In the DRIPA legislation, Section 3 is the section that says there's going to be this process of trying to bring British Columbia laws into conformity with the Articles of UNDRIP. But Section 7 of DRIPA actually says that the government can enter into agreements with Indigenous governments under which they either jointly share decision-making or Indigenous government's consent has to be obtained before the provincial government can make a decision. Now, those two provisions, in my view, are both undemocratic and I think probably unconstitutional, because I'm not sure in my mind that the province actually had the constitutional authority to unilaterally pass DRIPA in the first place. Now, I am aware that the residents of Pender Harbor, the Pender Harbor Residents Association, are actually bringing a constitutional challenge to the DRIPA legislation as a result of a series of steps in their area under which Sechelt First Nation are being proposed to have veto power over dock management issues and dock allocations. So Section 7 is very important, because Section 7 is what basically says, well, we can do agreements with Indigenous governments anywhere we want in the province over any land which we so choose. And we can require either they will make all the decisions jointly with us, the province, or even worse, they will be given a veto power over any decisions we want to make before we make them. Now, the Land Act amendments were born out of Section 7 and this view that it's appropriate somehow to have joint decision-making between First Nations and the government over land and resources in British Columbia. We're talking about lands that haven't been proven to be Aboriginal title lands under Canadian law. We're talking about the land that hasn't had Aboriginal title declarations made on it. So those two provisions were very much in this notion of making the Land Act consistent with UNDRIP. And so the government, I think, believes that participation in decision-making is mandated in UNDRIP. They clearly believe that the requirement for consent is mandated in UNDRIP. And as I say, have gone well beyond, in my view, Canadian constitutional law in trying to push those concepts into things like an amended Land Act to provide for joint or consent-based decision-making. So that all led, that of course created quite a backlash as I understand it, and I'm not particularly surprised by that. And then of course we had the declaration of Aboriginal title over Haida Gwaii. Now, because I worked on the Haida file as a government lawyer, I can't say very much about what I know about that negotiation because it's solicitor-client privileged. But I can tell you what I have seen happening since I retired. And what I've seen, of course, is the provincial government making a unilateral declaration of Section 35, that's Canadian law, Aboriginal title, over the entirety of the Haida Gwaii archipelago. That's 10,000 square kilometers of land. Now, the Chilcotin case, which everybody thought was pretty surprisingly huge, was a title declaration by the courts over 1,700 square kilometers of land. The Haida have been given, or have had returned to them, depending on your point of view, 10,000 square kilometers of land unilaterally by the provincial government, having negotiated with the Haida without the presence of the federal government, explicitly saying that what they've done is not a treaty, because it couldn't be without the federal government being present, and basically saying that the Haida have Aboriginal title allegedly over the entirety of the Haida Gwaii archipelago. Now, I would argue that a proper application of Canadian law in the Haida circumstance, I would argue, would be highly unlikely to result in a 10,000 square kilometer award of Aboriginal title to the Haida. I think, you know, without being cute about this, I think the Haida probably know that. And I think that their approach has been to convince a government to negotiate title of some form over the entirety of the archipelago. The last thing I'll say about the Haida agreement, I think that the legislation the province has passed is highly likely to be unconstitutional, because I don't believe a province can unilaterally pass legislation which is at the core of federal jurisdiction over Indigenous people. So without the federal government doing something, of a mirror legislation, I don't think the provincial legislation is actually constitutional. And I guess the question will arise as to whether anyone takes a run at the constitutionality of that legislation. Last thing I'll say about the Haida, the Haida deal, which to me is the most controversial. The Haida managed to get the government to agree to place that Aboriginal title declaration, if you like, over all of the private lands on Haida Gwaii. So it's not just the public lands, but all of the private lands as well. I would argue that government was under no obligation at all to do that. And I'm assuming that the Haida basically negotiated that result. And so now we have private land on Haida Gwaii, which is subject, allegedly, to this title that the province has supposedly created, Aboriginal title over the private land. Now, various people have said, well, that's okay, because the government negotiated an ability to retain provincial jurisdiction over those private lands, and therefore it's all okay. Well, a couple of issues with that. I think it's fair to say that the Haida, if they have accepted Aboriginal title over those private lands, are arguably in a position of having surrendered their title, because those lands can be disposed to third parties. Canadian Aboriginal law says Aboriginal title cannot be disposed by an Indigenous community to a third party. Or the other possibility is that the private lands now being burdened by this so-called Haida Aboriginal title have probably just been devalued massively. Because how do you go to the bank? How do you go to an investor? How do you go anywhere and say to them, look, I have this piece of property on Haida Gwaii, but it's subject to this thing that the province has put in place over it called Haida Aboriginal title. What are you going to do with that? And my suggestion is putting Aboriginal, intentionally putting Aboriginal title over private lands is really stunningly difficult proposition. And I don't think that anything anybody's said about jurisdictional issues has changed my view of that. Now, why is that important? And I'll stop after this comment. This is important because Premier Eby said after the Haida arrangement was put in place that this was a template for what is possible in the rest of the province. Now, I just ask people whom I talk to think about that for a minute. If this is the template, does that mean, first of all, that we're going to be recognizing everybody's claims of Aboriginal title under UNDRIP to all the lands that they've ever used, and then applying an Aboriginal title to the private lands within those territories? Because the Premier said this himself, it's a template for the rest of the province. And so I personally find that quite frightening, but I'm not in government. I'm not advising government anymore. But I would say that the reason I find it frightening is because it's all being done in total secrecy. And their interpretations of UNDRIP are much broader than applying Section 35, as they said when they introduced the legislation in the legislature.
And that leads me to really the final question here of what this means for the average British Columbian going forward after October 19th. Is the Haida deal a plan B or a template, or could the Land Act amendments come back in a different form?
Right. So my answer to that and my abiding issue with all of this, since I watched it after I retired, I couldn't stop watching it because I was interested. My abiding issue is the government hasn't told anybody what their plans are for DRIPA. They have not told anybody what their plans are for Section 7 agreements and how broadly they're intending to do those agreements. They haven't said anything about whether they intend to apply those agreements in the private land context. The Haida situation seems to indicate that they are going to barrel forward using a very broad interpretation of UNDRIP to create unilaterally, without the federal government, Aboriginal title over all kinds of lands in BC. The Haida model says, including private lands. And so the issue in all of this, there's two issues for me. One is, they said this was all going to be implemented consistent with Canadian constitutional law. I would say it certainly is not in any sense consistent with Canadian constitutional law. The second thing I would say is that no one has any idea what this government may do with this scheme. They've given themselves the power under DRIPA to basically do whatever they want, and unfortunately have been, I think, in my view, hiding the true agenda from the general public. I hear a lot of talk about the program of decolonizing British Columbia for good. I don't know what that means, but I gotta say, I think the general public need to know what the government means by that before the 19th of October.
So Jeffrey Moyes, former executive counsel, Office of the Deputy Attorney General with the British Columbia government, advised six BC governments over 30 years. Thank you again for joining us on this podcast.
I would say you're very welcome, and I would invite people to ask the government of the day, the government of today, what's going on, and understand that before the 19th.
That was my guest, Jeffrey Moyes, former executive counsel in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General for British Columbia. To listen to the full interview, including historical background on the history of First Nations treaty making and land settlements in BC, go to bobmackin.substack.com starting October 14th.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, dual citizenship petition for foreign residents in Taiwan meets signature threshold. Government expected to deliberate on proposal and issue response within 2 months. The Crossroads Group's petition reached its necessary goal in early October, achieving over 5,200 signatures weeks before the deadline of October 20th. The 38,000 foreigners who have obtained permanent residence, quote, lack equal access to many public services, assistance and benefits afforded to citizens, as well as representation in public affairs, end quote. In Hong Kong Free Press, U.S. chain Garrett Popcorn announces departure from Hong Kong in 13 years amid wave of business closures. Founded in 1949, Garrett Popcorn is based in Chicago and has overseas branches in 9 countries and territories. It currently has 10 stores in Singapore and 4 in Hong Kong. The announcement came amid a wave of business closures, especially from the food and beverage sector over the past year. In Kyoto News, Japan's new top diplomat agrees with China to build stable ties. Foreign Minister Takeshi Iwaya and his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi discussed potential areas of bilateral cooperation and agreed to continue dialogue. During their 45-minute talks, Iwaya told Wang that the Japanese government is closely watching the developments surrounding Taiwan and reiterated the importance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait to the international community, including Japan. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, fentanyl, not reforms, fueled Oregon's overdose spike, asserts new study. Fentanyl came along at exactly the wrong time for proponents of drug decriminalization. Measure 110 went into effect in February 2021, just as the drug swept into Oregon. Bowing to public pressure, Oregon legislators recriminalized drug possession this year, levying misdemeanor charges on offenders starting on September 1st. In Crosscut, Washington sues TikTok for underplaying youth mental health risks. It joined 20 other states. The lawsuit alleges that TikTok has published misleading public statements about the platform's content moderation, despite its own research showing the risks to young users. TikTok employs an arsenal of harmful, addictive-by-design features tailored for exploiting, manipulating, and capitalizing on young users' still developing brains, said the government news release. And in the Breaker.news, go check out this new development. We have a Substack page. Go look for bobmackin.substack.com. That's Bob Mackin, all one word, .substack.com. Go there, check it out, and subscribe, and tell your friends. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.news podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the unsung heroes who are helping people find clean, safe, and affordable housing in BC. Thank you for all you do. We need more of you, and we need more housing in BC. It's Homelessness Action Week in BC from October 13th to 19th. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.news podcast for the week of October 13th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 13th of October in 1986, Expo 86 closed at BC Place Stadium, Vancouver's World's Fair on Transportation and Communication on the shores of False Creek and at Canada Place. It opened May 2nd, 1986. By the time it was over, the attendance was 22.1 million people. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Yes, go visit me there on Substack. Again, that's bobmackin.substack.com. And you can sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly known as Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.